ourselves, or we will continue to be a defenseless people at the mercy of a ruthless and violent racist mob.
That was Malcolm X speaking in 1964. He would be assassinated at the Audubon Ballroom on February 21st, 1965. Today, if he had lived, he would have been 90 years old. That does it for our broadcast. We have video production fellowships. Also, happy birthday to Samin Farkhunde. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today's guest is Portland Public School Board member Steve Buell, and we'll talk about the state of our public school system.
Did you know that KBOO's daily evening newscast is produced by a team of volunteers right here in our Portland studios? If you've got some extra time and would like to get free training in radio news production, come on down to the studio and get involved. You can learn interviewing, writing, editing, and production skills, all for free, in a fun and supportive environment. Call KBOO's volunteer coordinator, Ani Haynes, at 503-231-8032 to get involved. That number again is 503-231-8032 to volunteer with the KBOO Evening News.
Hi, this is Justin Miller, KBOO's underwriting coordinator. Every day, local businesses support KBOO through program sponsorship or underwriting. These underwriters are people like you, progressive, diverse, and supporting real radio. So when you hear an underwriter's acknowledgement, consider giving them some of your business and telling them that you heard about them on KBOO. If your business would like to reach out to the area's 55,000 most diverse and progressive listeners, you can learn how at kboo.fm/underwriting, by email to underwriting@kboo.org, or call Justin, 503-231-8032. KBOO Underwriting. Your clients are listening.
Speaking of underwriting, this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Five Centers for the Arts, presenting The Bicycle Men, a bawdy musical comedy featuring Second City alumni. The Bicycle Men tells the story of Steve, a hapless American cyclist whose bike breaks down in a small French village. The Bicycle Men on stage June 5th through June 7th at the Winningstad Theater. Tickets and information at portland5.com.
This is KBOO, 90.7 on your FM dial here
it
in
is.
Portland.
Yes.
It is.
It is.
We really are. Abe's here. We have a guest, Steve Buell, who's on the school board. Now, we're going to talk about, and Steve is going to be talking about, our situation with the management at the highest levels of the Portland Public Schools. We are not going to advocate for or put down candidates specifically because that's against the rules.
Right. We're not even going to talk about cable.
We're not going to talk about that. But I do want to remind people that today is the last day for you to cast your ballot for the school board. And this has been a very interesting school board election in that a lot of money's been put into it.
It's true.
Unusually so, I think. And it is a very, very important juncture in the history of the Portland Public Schools.
I actually had a conversation with one of the candidates.
You did?
I did, about money.
Money.
This candidate informed me that someone in the know had advised that that the candidate would need to raise at least $50,000 to have any hope of winning.
But there's no, that you don't get paid to be on the school
board. No, you don't.
So.
But 50 grand to 50 even grand? Have a shot at winning a seat on the Portland School Board.
Well, so much for a citizen body, eh?
Hey.
Hey. Okay, Steve, welcome.
Thank you.
So what we want to do today, and I think this is, first of all, again, now people must take their ballots down to the Multnomah County ballot office, which is on Morrison, right? Morrison in the southeast here.
Yeah, or to a library branch.
Or to a library branch. And it's really, I have my ballots right here, and I'm going to take them down. I'm going to stick them in the box, and everybody's going to be cheering.
Right. Yeah. Can you get that on video for me?
No.
Okay.
Anyway, I really want to have some full disclosure. I did work for the Portland Public Schools as a PR guy back in the bad times of CETA and that mini depression. And I worked for John Neller, who was the head of public information for the Portland Public Schools, the PR office. And it was a very closely run operation. During that time, I discovered the fact that the Oregonian's education reporter was a close friend, shall we say, with the board secretary, who was part of the administrative in-group. And it always seemed to me at the time that there might thereby be a conflict of interest. Nobody in the schools was worried about that, and I don't think the general public was aware of that. But it gave me a taste of insider-outsider stuff in the Portland Public Schools. It's just a taste. So that kind of set me up for a bit of cynicism about how the schools were operated. Now, this is many years later, we've gone through a great struggle on integrating schools, the whole business of busing has been done away with. A lot of good things have happened, but... Yeah,
there's buses for nobody now.
Yeah, but... Yeah, right. But we're at another school crisis. And what I'm hoping you, Steve Buell, can do, without talking about specific candidates, or advocating, I should say, for specific candidates, what's going on? Is there an in-group operating the school board? Is there a clique in power? What's up?
Well, I think there's four people on the school board who've acted together as a group to take the schools in the directions that they wanted to go. And there's two people on the school board, Tom Curler and I, who've kind of been opposed to some of those directions. And then there's one person on the school board, Bobby Reagan, who's kind of been in both camps. So that's how the politics of the school board work right now.
Well, wait a minute. That means four. How many people are on the board?
Seven. Seven.
So that means four people meeting with the administration.
Well, they don't always meet with the administration. What's taking place is basically the what they call the co-chairs. They sit down with the administration in the back rooms. I kept calling them the back rooms and kind of make those decisions. And then the decisions get made, it seems to me, often based upon aligning everybody up. Make sure everybody okay with this, and so forth. So basically, the school board, who's supposed to act as an open body and transparent body, has not been acting that way. That's one of the things I've been trying to fight, because when you go into the back rooms to make decisions, we all know who gets left out.
Well, now you've been portrayed in the press and elsewhere as kind of the bad boy of the board.
Now, they did have that Willamette Week article.
Right. And that you're a bomb thrower, I think was the term used.
That's an old term that they used before. Comes actually not out of Willamette Week, but probably out of Stand for Children.
Uh-huh. So, But what I want to know, you say there's four people. Can you, we can name them. I mean,
sure.
Who are they?
Matt Morton, Greg Belisle, Pamela Knowles, and Ruth Atkins.
And these,
Pamela Knowles has really been, in the 2 years that I've been on the school board, she's been in the leadership role, mm-hmm. and either as the chairperson or the vice chairperson for the whole 2 years, pretty much running the school system.
What are some of the issues, primary issues that you're concerned with and that you see as crisis producing with the Portland Public
One of
schools.
The primary issues is where we spend the money. Do we spend it down in the classroom directly with people who work directly with children? And I've been pushing to do that more. Another major issue is how do you involve people within the school board decisions and within the school district decisions? I've pushed and pushed to try and get teachers more involved. I'd like to be making decisions based on basically what's good for kids down the line. In other words, sit down, really what the model for decision making, in my opinion, should be is to sit down and bring in people who have to do with the issues that you're discussing and put out the ideas and discuss those issues in a really open and honest way, and then come forward with some solutions or improvements to those problems and move from there. I don't think that's the way that that we're doing it now.
So the Willamette Week article that we just referenced, published on April 8th, it describes you as cranky, irritating, and stubborn, but also a surprising force for change in Portland public schools. What's that article about?
Well, that article tried to talk about the role that I've had on the school board. I don't think they did a particularly good job. One of the things that they totally missed is that I've been pushed into a position of having to act as a person who disrupted things to a certain degree, mm-hmm. because I couldn't get the school board to move in the directions that they needed to in other ways. And a lot of that's around just how we run the meetings, how we run the whole system in terms of whether it's done out in the open, for one thing, whether it's done according to the open meetings laws. And so I've kind of pushed on some of those things. The other thing is that I was told very early by Greg Belisle that you're not going to get to do anything, Steve, on the school board. You don't get to do anything. I came in with a pretty good mandate on the school board, took off an incumbent, and came in with a mandate to do some things, and they just said, basically, you're not going to get to do anything, period. You know, we're not going to let you make motions. We're going to restrict what you say, and so forth and so forth. And basically, the only avenue open to me was to disrupt the system to get people to understand how it was actually working in Portland. So that was the underlying issue that really didn't come forward in that. And there was a reason that I was trying to bring attention to the school board with some of the things that I did. There wasn't anything that I did that I feel bad about. I still think it was the right approach because it's the only approach I was given.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. If you'd like to call and join this conversation, the number to call is 503-231-8187. We're here in studio with Steve Buell of the Portland Public Schools Board. So broadly speaking, Steve, what is the difference between the way the school board conducts business now and the way you believe it ought to?
Well, they've made some changes in those directions. It's what's supposed to happen is that the superintendent is supposed to be in charge and run the school district. And she's supposed to do that based on what the school board has put forward as the general idea of how it should happen. And in order to have that happen, though, you have to have the discussions at the school board level. You have to have people involved. And basically, we don't discuss things at the school board level, really. The agenda is all made up by the co-chairs, and those are the only things that we're allowed to discuss, nothing beyond that. And the decisions are made pretty much before they end up at the school board level. They're made in the email streams and so forth, which is fine to a certain degree, but it's really not fine when what you're really working to do as a school board, which is what I think now that we're trying to do as a school board, is just get everybody lined up, not do what's best for the children in the school system.
Well, specifically, I mean, give us some examples of what's happening that you think are things detrimental to the education of the kids.
Well, one of the main thing, in my opinion, is where we spend the money. We spent $28 million that we found during the school year. In other words, we had $28 million more than we thought. Mm-hmm. We spent $28 million. Very little of it went directly into schools. I'm begging them to do, for instance, reading teachers. We have tons of kids who can't read, and the way you do that is to have reading teachers out there. We had maybe 5 or 6 reading teachers out of that $28 million. That's about $600,000, if that. That's one of the main things. There's a lot of push on the testing that we're not working on in a manner where we're saying, okay, look, this testing can be really destructive in the school system. What are we doing to mitigate, to get it so it's not as destructive? The answer is really nothing. I tried to pass a motion where you had a person who kind of would take a look at the testing this spring and see the mistakes we made, mm-hmm. and so forth. And so next year when we do it again, we would be able to not make those same mistakes. The answer from my colleagues on the school board, other than Tom Curler, was, well, it's not important. Well, it's critically important that we do something like that. We're putting kids on tests that don't know English. They don't know any English, and yet we're giving them the test, expecting them to take this test in English. We're putting, we're just not really looking at this destructiveness of the testing within the system. That's a great example. Those are great examples of where we should be doing things differently.
Yeah, but $28 million is a bunch of money.
Yeah, it's a bunch of money.
So where did it go?
A lot into process and similar
process. What is process? I'm sorry.
Well, process is let's train the teachers to do the Common Core better. Well, or let's do this program that we're bringing in, mm-hmm. where, for instance, instead of really looking at what we're doing within our schools, mm-hmm. we're kind of have this idea of, well, let's make sure that the central administration is taken care of in terms of their programs, and those programs then get pushed down to the schools. And I think it should be reversed, that the schools should figure out what they should be doing to help their children learn better, and then the central administration should be supporting the schools. Just the reverse. So a lot of it went into things dealing with the central administration and programs and those types of things.
Let's go to the phones. 231-8187. Who do we have? Joanne.
Yeah, I'm having trouble talking because my neck and shoulders hurt. So, the present Portland School Board politics, does it have any connection with John Kitzhaber not being governor anymore? And also one more, special education, has it improved any, or does it still exist? My granddaughter dropped out. Bye.
Bye. Thank you for the call, Joanne.
The Kitzhaber situation is Kitzhaber had begun to move money out of the common school fund. He had $650 million that the Oregon Educational Investment Board had moved out of the common school fund, mm-hmm. Oregon's fund, and was being spent in places outside of the K-12 educational system. And when Kate Brown came in, she shifted that back. So to some degree, the answer is yes. We just did the NEA project, which is kind of money going to a community-based organization.
NEA is what?
It's the Native American Youth Association. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I'm just saying that in the state, according to the Kitzhaber people, the money, we wanted to shift money into the community-based organizations. For instance, now there's a big move to do 0-3. Well, what is our responsibility as a school district? Our money is given to us for K-12. We did, at Clarendon School, we did put some money into preschool. Well, what is our responsibility there? So that is a political thing going on at the school board actually right now. The special ed is still going on. Yes, in fact, we're in the middle of a big trauma, really, over what they call behavioral classrooms. And we've
moved. Wait, what's a behavioral classroom?
A classroom where you help children who are having difficulty with their behavior. Mm-hmm. And you help them specifically, and you generally move those children into a classroom of their own, kind of, and then you filter them back into certain spots. Well, we've tried to move to a more inclusive situation where we've taken children who were in those classrooms and moved them, particularly young children, and moved them into directly into classrooms, and the teachers are, a lot of them are really upset because they say, that's fine, but where's the support? Mm-hmm. And so that's a big deal going on right now. That's the big special ed. And the special ed has always been a little edgy in Portland. It's a difficult topic. It's a really difficult topic.
I was thinking about all of this, and the classic functions of public education, I always thought, not officially, but in reality, were to train people for the necessary skills, including literacy and, I don't know, arithmetic, what is the term?
Numeracy.
Numeracy, thank you. Yep. And these were seen as necessary skills for the new industrial society. And public schools generally were a process that took a vast amount of the labor force and put them in schools, which helped to elevate the salaries, the incomes of working men and women in the regular industrial economy.
Well, it helped to elevate their technical competency as well.
Well, hopefully. But that whole thing now is almost irrelevant. It doesn't really read. It's like we're talking about 1920s. In another century, in another situation, 100 years different. And I also think that we now know more about behavioral activity. We strap kids, strapping is a metaphor here, we strap kids down and we expect them to sit there and get permission to go to the toilet, permission to do this or that or the other thing. And otherwise, they're supposed to sit there and concentrate on material being directed to them from a variety of sources, but mainly from teachers. And I remember school. I went to school in a lot of different places. My parents were very mobile. And in almost every case, I spent a lot of time designing tanks out of erasers and drawing pictures and not paying attention. And I'm gonna assume that that was not uncommon. So I see it as a an unproductive environment for really learning much, either much fact or much ways of learning how to think and consider ideas. I wonder if you had any thought on that.
Well, I think it's changing to a certain degree, and I've always stood for a good, solid, comprehensive, engaging education. That's what we need to do. We need to engage kids. We need to give them a good, solid basics, and we need to give them a good comprehensive education. The problem is that with the new testing that's coming in, mm-hmm. it's kind of being really destructive, and in a way it's pushing education back to what you were talking about, sit there, do these particular things. Mm-hmm. And we need to deal with that in some manner. The whole country's gone nuts, because people are making a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars on the testing. That's how we got it. That's why we got it. It's, it has nothing to do with kids, and yet they couch it in this idea that our education system is broken and struggling, even though it's basically not. And it is struggling, but it's not broken. And they couch it in that, so you have the testing now has come out and taken over, so, and it pushes the comprehensive education out. So kids who, we don't have as interesting things as we need for children in mm-hmm. school, and we it creates a lot of problems, from not just the dropout problems, but also the fact that when you can finish the education, it's not particularly very good because it's not wide enough.
Well, I also remember, and I'm wondering, I think this is still true. What we were essentially being taught was the conventional American capitalist ideology. When we studied American history, which in those days I think was the eighth grade and then again in high school, we were taught that every event in American history turned out for the best. that the Mexican War, for example, was a good thing, that the Spanish-American War was a good thing, that World War I was a good thing, and so on. And yet, as a historian and sociologist, I know that the issues are far more complex. And in fact, it's an interesting question. I mean, why do we ignore the genocide of the Native American peoples? Why do we ignore the fact of the taking of vast numbers of Africans to America, turning them into slaves for generations, and have still not rectified the injustices there? Why do we ignore the fact that there is a vast population of Americans, and I don't care about citizenship issues, Americans, who, if we hadn't had the Mexican War, would in fact be citizens of Mexico, who speak Spanish and who are being essentially treated as second-class citizens. I mean, all of that is really troubling to me. And that is part of what I would call a reasonable, fundamental, I guess you'd call it radical, but fundamental critique of what's going on. And I don't know what to think about that, except that I don't think the schools do anything but essentially propagandize at the most simplistic level. It all ends, you know, it all ends good.
Maybe it's the difference in our ages, perhaps, or maybe I just got lucky, but I was encouraged, I remember starting probably in middle school, to think very critically about concepts like manifest destiny and its consequences. I remember being taught to, you know, the movements like the civil rights movement in the 1960s, and principled resistance to unjust laws was a good thing. Mm. I remember very clearly being taught about these things.
Well, I learned it is a difference in our age, for sure.
I learned in high school economics the straight truth about Keynesian economics and how President Roosevelt's spending helped pull us out of the Great Depression. I mean, that's heresy now, but these are things I learned in public schools.
Interesting. That is really interesting.
And I think that Abe is probably closer to the experience that people are getting today.
So it is more critical.
It is more critical. One of the problems, and I hate to come back to this in a way, but one of the things that the testing does is push out the history. And so I've been trying, for instance, to work to get the school district to move in a direction of doing a better job of cultural history, of, you know, African American history, Latino history, Native American history, and particularly in the lower grades, that we should be teaching that as part of our curriculum, and it should be in there. And I'm having trouble getting them to go with that. I really am. Even people on the school board who really care about that stuff, I can't get them to go.
That's interesting. We're going to take some more calls. 231-8187. Who do we have?
Robert.
My name's Robert.
Robert. Good morning.
Hey, how's it going, you guys?
Pretty good.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for the work you're doing, by the way, and thanks for being a voice of sanity on the insane school board. I've got a couple kids in Portland Public Schools, and I'm pretty familiar with kind of how things work in the school system. And from my perspective, it seems like it's just been a long history, including now, of the haves and the have-nots in the school district, and there's a stark difference between the North End and the South End, and, you know, the Jefferson, Roosevelt, Madison cluster and the rest of the school district, and disequilibrium of resources, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just wondering what, I guess, you know, the school district talks about equity, and then they close down Humboldt and a couple of the schools in Jefferson cluster immediately after they, you know, they start their courageous conversation stuff. You know, their actions and their words don't align. They never do, and they never have. And the kids that get the brunt of it are the poor kids and the kids of color throughout the school district. And that's pretty much been the history that's continuing today. And it's really alarming. And, you know, the school district is great at paying lip service to equity and all these things, but their policies and their actions are totally contradictory to those goals and those values and ethics. And I'm wondering what you have to say about that, and what you've been doing. We're constantly fighting to kind of just keep programs intact and keep our schools from being shut down up here in Northeast Portland. And they're constantly conniving and coming up with new ways. And I don't trust them. Nobody trusts them up here about what they're going to do, what schools are going to close. what schools are going to realign and et cetera, et cetera. And the K-8 system is a joke. I mean, the K-8 schools or the K-8, you know, it's we wanted comprehensive middle schools. We never wanted the Vicki Phillips K-8 stuff, and that was imposed on us, just like other things have been imposed on us up here in Northeast Portland. Anyway, I just wanted to see what you had to say about that.
Yeah, I appreciate your comments, and let's give Steve Buell a chance to respond.
Yeah, I think that, Robert, there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. I really do. And the way that I kind of look at this whole system is you have to go and look and see how the schools are working. If the school's working in your neighborhood, then you're ahead of the game. And if it's not, then we need to get in there and straighten out what the problems are. And a lot of that is resources and putting that money down closer to the classroom. If you got a lot of kids who can't read, then you need reading teachers. We're finally, and I think I had a lot to do with this, though I'm not really sure, because you never can tell on the school board anymore what you have a lot to do with or not, because they don't do things in the open meetings straight out. But they're now, we're going to put librarians in, make sure that all the libraries are open every day, and start putting certified librarians, which are called teacher librarians now, teacher librarians into every school. And it's wonderful, because it's the basis for getting children to read. And that's how I kind of look at it. And the question is, how is the school working? What do we need to do to make it work? I've tried to stay focused on that principle. It's really tough because I don't have much help. Tom Curler, I think, buys into that, and a couple people coming in the school board will, depending on how the elections come out, I think we'll maybe get some help along that line, and that hopefully will make a lot of difference.
Well, I also think about this pattern. I don't know the finances. I'm not skilled in that area. But the pattern of having, we used to have a lot of little schools. The schools were built during a period of population growth, generally, of young people. And now, over the most recent years, we've seen the shutting down of these smaller schools. The argument is they're inefficient, they cost too much to run, et cetera, et cetera. But it has always seemed to me that a more intimate environment for education, particularly in the younger years, is incredibly valuable, just as a smaller classroom size, number of students, is incredibly valuable. And I just wonder what's going on there.
Well, we did go into back to the K-8s under Vicki Phillips, and they did it for the wrong reasons. They said they did it because the achievement was better, which was a bunch of hokey. It wasn't necessarily the case. A lot of times educators will just buy and get research and have it be sloppy research and then use it to make their case. But the K-5 schools in Portland have generally all worked very well. You have all these little kids in one spot and you focus on them, and it makes a lot of difference. And so I've always felt that's kind of the way to go. The problem is when you get into the middle school, in order to make a middle school work, you get so many kids of that age in one spot, you got to really have the resources. And when we talk about middle school, if we're going to talk about it, we should have the resources that are necessary to make it work. I taught in Vancouver for 10 years in a middle school called Covington. And man, it was unbelievable what we had. It was unbelievable.
Can I interject?
Sorry. Pardon me?
Sure.
Sorry, I taught at Covington too after working in PPS.
Oh, did you?
I was blown away. I couldn't believe what they had going on there.
It's unbelievable.
It was just crossing the river. It was same socioeconomic status, schools, same poverty level, and I was blown away. I don't know how they can do that over there, and we do this over here. I guess that's why we're 49th and Washington's 24th or something like that in state funding of schools. But the K-8 stuff is an example of just a, you know, it was imposed on Northeast Portland and the Jefferson cluster, Madison cluster, et cetera. We didn't want that system. It wasn't resourced. If they had resourced it correctly, it might have been successful. But all it did was put us at a disadvantage, put the kids at a disadvantage. The League of Women Voters, you know, report on the whole K-8 system that Vicki Phillips imposed was, you know, it's a scandal. And there should be a class action lawsuit by parents, if you know, and maybe that's coming down the road. But it's just an example of how the school system has consistently imposed its will on the poorer clusters and underfunded them and just set us up for failure again and again, et cetera. And we're not, you know, when you're set up for failure, they're gonna set the standards for describing that failure, and they're gonna call you a failure. It's, you know, just like Bush did with No Child Left Behind. And, you know, it's a travesty, and it's just continuing, unfortunately.
I'm going to let you go and give some other people an opportunity. I appreciate your comments. I'm looking at this whole situation, and I feel that any parent trying to steer their children or child through this system faces a maze of bureaucratic in interference and essentially indifference. And my intuition is that things like No Child Left Behind simply are alienating and threatening and take up a lot of classroom time for no specific educational purpose. And I wondered how you feel about that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's built around the testing and the corporate reform movement so people can make a lot of money. It's not set up for children. And I'm one of the founders of an organization called Oregon Save Our Schools, which is the big anti-testing people. We were really influential. The most influential on the opt-out movement, getting people to opt out of the testing and say, look, this is not working for our children. This is not good for our children. And I hope people will continue to opt out.
Well, and the whole testing process with the testing booklets and the little mark thing.
On the computers now.
Oh, they're on computers.
Well, yeah, $200 million by Bill Gates. He put in to push for the Common Core, which is the standards that we're testing against. And guess where we've bought all the way across the country buy a lot of computers just to get yourself to the point where you can actually test the kids that you have.
Oh, wow. And do those computers run Microsoft software?
I would imagine so.
Mm. Oh, just an accident. Just a coincidence. No, nothing nothing underhanded here.
Let's go back to the phones.
Yeah, 231-8187. Who do we got?
Leslie, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm both a PBS parent and a PBS teacher. I'm actually a special ed teacher, and I've worked in a lot of different schools in the district, but for about the past 6 or 7 years, one of my assignments is at a charter school. So I just wanted to say the school that I work at, the charter school, is an incredible school. It does an amazing job of a lot of the things that I think a lot of the public schools don't do, which is it's small, it's incredibly nurturing, there's an incredibly involved parent body. It's also very diverse. We have probably percentage-wise one of the most diverse elementary schools in the district, and the kids are just involved in really creative and hands-on work as well as having really high academic standards. And it really upsets me that charter schools get so demonized. I mean, I'm a part of the union, and I know the union is very anti-charter school, and I understand why. But I just want to say I work with the teachers who are employed by the charter school, are all certified teachers who have chosen to take a much reduced salary to work in a much more supportive environment. And I mean, I just really wish that we had a way of looking at these schools, that some of which are so successful and are doing such a great job, and instead of trying to stamp them out with this demonization of charter schools, I think we have a lot to learn from these small schools. And
well, what do you mean by demonization? What kind of things are being said that you feel are untrue?
From all kinds of levels. I mean, I think people, from an equity perspective, people say that the charter schools are taking money away from neighborhood schools and causing them to close down. When in fact, I mean, what I see at our school is we have so many kids on the waiting list, there's no way that we could possibly accommodate the demand there is for this school. But to say that this tiny little school is causing neighborhood schools to close down, I think is just a complete misnomer. And I think people should have a choice to send their children to a much better school and not have to pay for it. And that's what some of the really good charter schools are offering. And I think that if we get into those poor and underserved neighborhoods and let people know about charter schools, those people are choosing. I mean, we have people from those neighborhoods choosing these schools. So I don't think that the idea that, you know, these schools are only for privileged kids whose parents, you know, are educated and find out about them and make the effort to send them there, I don't think that's an accurate characterization, but they are characterized that way. And the union also tends to see charter schools as anti-union, which is at least in my school, the farthest thing from the truth. I mean, our director there, when we were potentially going to go on strike, was in a huge dilemma because she would like to have closed the school if we had gone on strike to support us, but legally she couldn't because mm-hmm. of their charter. So I just feel like there's a lot of misinformation out there about charter schools, and the school board traditionally has been very anti-charter school. And I just think that, you know, the perspective needs to change so we can understand that when schools are offering a really great education that's really child-centered, we need to enable them to do that, not try to get rid of them, which is the district. I mean, I have to say, like, even as a special ed teacher assigned to a charter school, I don't work for the charter school. I work for PPS. But I am treated like I represent a charter school, and mm-hmm. it is not pleasant, let me tell you.
Well, I appreciate your comments. My immediate response, my concern, my personal concern, is that there can be a lot of charter schools that essentially are teaching a religious curriculum and so on, and there's no real control on that, in addition to the conventional curriculum. But I think we should turn to Steve Buell and get his response.
Well, what she's describing as a charter school sounds like an excellent school. It's the type of thing that really we want in the public schools themselves. I mean, charter schools are public schools, but in that, we're going to make a distinction, I guess. Part of the problem is Oregon has a different little approach to charter schools. We still have not had the big charter school groups where they come in to make money. Mm-hmm. You go back east in places and they were closing down public schools and giving them to charter schools. Mm-hmm. And the charter schools don't have any better record than anybody else, really. They're not much different than when you go through their national record. What she's talking about, what she's getting in her school as a charter school, the caring about the kids, the dedication, the type of education, we should be having that in the public schools. That's one of the things I'm working for, is to make public schools more like the charter schools she's in. But it doesn't automatically mean that if you have a charter school that it's better or worse mm-hmm. than a public school. It's just different the way they get the money and so forth, and they have a little more autonomy. And the ideas behind the charter schools, the original ideas, which were, okay, let's get rid of all the bureaucratic garbage that goes along and let's educate children more according to a more sensible approach. That's her charter school sounds like they do that. They're not doing that across the country in charter schools. Mm-hmm. And they're making a lot of money, lots and lots and lots of money on charter schools. And that is what they're about in a lot of other areas. So Oregon's a little bit different. We haven't got there yet. I'm hope that we won't, and the charter schools that we have will remain pretty good ones, which seems to be the case, good ones.
Yeah, so we're seeing I'll get back to you in a second. Hang on.
Okay.
We're seeing two things that are concerning about charter schools. Number one, I see a pattern where the great struggle of fundamentalism versus a more scientifically based society, let's call it, is playing out in some charter schools in some locations. I don't think that's a problem here very much. The other question is a question of privilege and access and so on. I think what you're describing is how schools ought to be. But what were you going to say? You had one other point you wanted to make.
Well, what I wanted to say is that I don't know what the laws are around charter schools in other states, but I spend a lot of time talking to our director at the charter school I work at, and mm-hmm. we are not allowed to have, and there's no intention at this school ever to have anything religious, but we also have the same, we operate by the same rules that all the public schools operate by, mm-hmm. which is we can't have anything religious, which I think is great. So I don't know if charter schools in other states, and I've heard the same thing that you're talking about the fundamentalist push and all that, but what I do know is that the laws we're operating under here in Oregon would not allow that, and certainly the few charter schools I know about that are doing a great job have absolutely no intention of doing that. One of the things that I would really like to see in the public schools, which, and I, you know, it's way too complicated of a system for me to understand why this isn't possible, but I love the fact that we have in Portland an option for a Waldorf-inspired charter school, a project-based in charter school, a Montessori-based school. I mean, we are able to offer kids and parents choices. I mean, there isn't a one-size-fits-all philosophy of education for families or children, and the fact that our charter schools are able to offer those choices, I think, is such a treasure that we have and something we're so lucky to have. And I just really hope that people can see that. And I think the idea of equity, to me, it's like, well, let's try to make that available to more children and more locations instead of saying, oh, no, these charter schools are bad, you know. Anyway, that's just my point.
No, I appreciate your point. I think it is certainly the case that a one style uniform school system may not suit every child, and it is an interesting issue. I am always concerned for the rightness of teachers to organize and so on, and I'm also very concerned with curriculum and how easily it can be embedded with ideas that are not scientific or not real or ideologically based rather than fact based. But certainly what you're describing sounds like great education.
Hey, thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I would have to agree. Yes, the charter school system is far from perfect, but it does offer some useful alternatives. And it's good to have alternatives to traditional doctrine.
Yeah, but I'm very concerned with what is happening in the United States generally. We're seeing working people be made more and more weak in terms of organization. Charter school programs, as Steve has talked about in other places, have kind of served as union busting devices.
Mm-hmm. And money making. Money making and union busting.
And money making. And that is a great concern. I'm not suggesting that's the case here, but we need to be aware of that. Yes. We have to do some business.
We do. This is KBOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial. Coming up this morning at 9 on Alternative Radio, a classic speech by the late Howard Zinn. It's called Against War. I think I saw to use Howard Zinn as a high school history textbook. That would be a good curriculum choice.
It's not quite complete enough. Not enough about the Whigs.
Oh, not enough about the Whigs.
Yeah.
At 10, Eric Cascadia is off today. We'll have Flashpoints, which features a recent speech given by American Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges. At 11, on stage and studio, guest host Sarika Mehta speaks with B. Beeman, a Sri Lankan-American singer-songwriter with a unique voice. At 11:30, Art Focus is off today. Instead, we'll hear Big Picture Science, featuring a forensic scientist who develops tools to create a mugshot based on a snippet of DNA, and a scientist working on mind reading. All this and more coming up on your empirically grounded, scientifically based public radio station, KBOO.
Not public.
Community. Radio station.
Yeah, and if you want to call us, 231-8187. Our guest is Steve Buell. He's on the school board. We're not talking about candidates. And today, pay attention here now, is the last day for you to submit your ballots for the school board, and you really, really want to participate in that election. It's interesting because it's the first time I've seen a lot of money being poured into a school board election.
Whether you not have kids or whether or not you have kids in school, it's still important.
Oh, it's very important. Yeah.
The phones?
Yeah, I guess we'll do the phones. 231-8187, who's there?
Sarah, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for being on the show and having me as well.
Sure.
So I'd like to first say that perhaps this has been covered earlier in the show. I was not able to listen, mm-hmm. In which case, thank you for repeating. And I want to also share that I do have a master's in education, mm-hmm. and I am a mother, and I have a student in the school district. I'm actually in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. But my concern crosses the state border, which is to put into a term that many people are familiar with, which is the school-to-prison pipeline.
Ah.
And I hear a response. My understanding, I just moved here from a different state. My understanding is that Washington and Oregon actually have some of the worst rates of basically racist suspensions of children. And the reality that children get tracked, especially children of color, get tracked from third grade based on their literacy scores
and the privatization of prisons, and the prison industrial complex formulates its estimation of how many rooms are needed in future prisons based on the reading scores of children of color, especially in third grade. And obviously this is a form of the modern slave system. You know, the entire movement from the plantation to the penitentiary to the prison system, and of course how the 13th Amendment did not abolish slavery but rather made it legal in the form of imprisonment for doing such things as being unemployed. And of course, when a person is enslaved one day and then the next day are quote-unquote free, however, if it's illegal to be unemployed, then they get rounded up in the chains, and that's how we have chain gangs and ongoing forms of slavery. And this is clearly a part of the foundation of institutionalized racism and oppression, and I'd like to hear how this is being handled in schooling, and only how the children are being educated, but how this is being addressed by the schools, because suspension of children of color is just off. It's off. It's racist, it's wrong, and I am part of a family of color, and so this is obviously of personal concern, but it's of social concern, and it's just the human way needs to be approached.
Okay, well, let's Steve Buell respond to that.
And thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, what she's doing, if we're talking, say, graduation rates, which is a similar type situation, then you've got a long range and a short range situation. The long range is to improve your school system immensely and get more children engaged as they move through the system into the schools. And the other thing is to make sure everybody can read and gets a really good, solid, comprehensive education, because that allows kids to go out and take part in society, which is a very, very helpful thing. That's the whole idea of the public school system. And so that particular aspect, I think you have to kind of look at it that way. I'm trying really hard to get kids to get those reading teachers in so we can get kids to read, and so we don't have so many children who are so far behind, and it creates all these problems. But the other thing that she raised is the discipline disparity situation, where mm-hmm. we exclude both in suspensions and expulsions more children of color than we do other children. And this is a critical thing that we need to work on. I think we've done an awful lot of talking, but not much real solid action. We have done some things. Our rates are going down. It's hard to tell whether the rates are going down because people aren't suspending kids, or because the whole system, kids are responding better and doing a better job, and so getting suspended less. It's hard to sort out. But what I've felt that we needed to do was to set up a system where each school has a good, solid disciplinary system, if you want to look at it that way. But basically, we have a couple programs that we're working on. One is PBIS, and one is where we try and work with kids and talk to them differently, kind of a social justice type program that's better, and restorative justice is the name of it. And I'm pushing now to try to get us to take those systems and put them together to make them really usable in all our schools. Now they're in a couple schools here, a couple schools there. I want to get a system which takes the best part of all these and works together with the teachers, so the teachers can actually use those particular systems. Now, for instance, if you sit down in a circle with a kid, it takes a lot of time to work that child through. Well, do you have time to do that instead of what you're teaching? How does this come out? And so we have this kind of the teachers versus what they're being asked to do, and there's not enough time. We need to really look at this and make sure, and I'm kind of advocating kind of a hybrid system, using the best of these programs mm-hmm. to put it together in a system where every school can actually use these. And that will hopefully have an impact
on discipline disparities, which are pretty big. They're pretty big.
What do you say to the caller's suggestion that the disproportionate suspension and expulsion of students of color is a precursor for the disproportionate incarceration of people of color?
Well, yeah, I think there's a connection. You bet. I read a book called The New Jim Crow, which talks about
Michelle Alexander.
Exactly. And I think there's some parallels with the school system, though I'm still working through exactly where those parallels are. But oh yeah, absolutely. And the key to it is to have good schools in all neighborhoods for all children. And we're a ways away from that yet. We've got schools where there's a lot of disruption, say, and then other schools where there's hardly any. Well, we're really not looking at the behavior as a part of the educational system, how that all fits together. The problem, if you don't like to send your child down the street to the neighborhood school, it's probably one of two reasons. And one is you don't think the behavior is that good in that school, and the second is you don't think the resources are there. Well, we're not afraid to talk about the resources, but we're very afraid to talk about the behavior situation.
Well, and I was just thinking about recently in the papers within the last year had been the discovery that one discipline technique at one school in Portland was to have Hispanic American students be turned into janitors as a punishment.
They had them in evidently cleaning the bathrooms, which unbelievable.
It's really quite incredible, and really exactly what you ought not to be doing, because you're essentially teaching these children that what their future will be is as manual, as the lowest level of manual labor. And it's just, I think it's just extremely racist, extremely unthoughtful, and yet it was happening. We're talking about until yesterday, virtually.
Well, one of the ways I think about that whole situation is think in terms of your family. Schools are way closer to a family situation than a business. And so we need to have specific consequences for things. If you have children and you don't have any consequences for your children, forget it. Your kids are going to come out in a horrible shape. We need to have consequences, but we need to think in terms of what they should be and how they should be set up and what makes sense. If we're not going to send kids home, which I don't like. Mm-hmm. I don't like the fact that we do send them home.
Expelling them.
Or suspending them even. Uh-huh. And if we're not going to, then where are the consequences? What is the system? That's where we need to really focus and talk about what we're doing and make it work. And we're not really doing that yet. I'm hoping to push them in those directions after this election. I'm hoping that I can have a little more power to push them in those directions.
You're thinking that the school board election will perhaps change the makeup of the board, consequently change the policies?
No, man, it could change it incredibly.
So this is a very important election.
To me, it's extremely important.
And I guess I want to remind people, this is that you now have to deliver your ballot, I guess, either to the library or to the main offices of the Multnomah County Register of Voters.
That's right.
And this is it.
Yep,
and hopefully a lot of people are doing that. Very important.
I hope so.
Postmarks do not count.
No, that's right. It's got to be in their hands.
Got to actually literally hand deliver it at this point. So we have some more callers.
Yeah, let's take another call before we sign off. Harry, good morning. Are you there?
Good morning.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Last year, Channel 6 News did a report on Portland Public Schools, the lead content in the paint in schools. And there was 24 schools in the public school district that still have lead in their lead paint in their schools, and we've discovered lead in paint in the late 70s, and the federal government gave Portland Public Schools millions of dollars, same thing with the state, to remove it. Yet we still have 24 schools with lead paint.
Yeah, I didn't realize that.
I didn't either.
That's quite serious, and I think it's a. I don't understand how that could happen. Really.
Yeah, I was hoping maybe you could check into that.
Yeah, I've talked actually to the head of the facilities department. One of the things, if that paint is flaking, we're after it. If it's not, we're not after it as much because it doesn't rise to the priority level. Mm-hmm. And we're really short of maintenance. That's not an excuse. It's just going out and taking all the paint off the walls, say, or off that it's not flaking. It's not really a problem unless it does flake. But I'm not making an excuse. I think you're absolutely correct, and it points directly to the fact that our maintenance has not been anywhere near what it should be over the years.
And the next question I have is, about a couple weeks ago, the Supreme Court ruled that Kit Copper couldn't raid the PERS.
I'm sorry. You're beginning to raise a really interesting question, but we're out of time. And I do apologize. And we'll probably deal with these questions at another time. And I thank you all for listening. I hope it was useful. I want to thank you, Steve Buell, for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Get your ballots in.
Yeah, get
your ballots. Today's
the day. Make the vote.
All right, we'll be back at you next week.
Against disorder from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Do you worry that corporate power is totally out of control? Tune into the KBOO Evening News every Tuesday evening at 5 p.m. beginning August 5th to hear the new weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. I'll be sharing stories about communities that are rising up against corporate control and passing laws that exercise their right to govern themselves. That's every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News beginning August 5th. Don't miss it.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First, on alternative radio, they present a classic speech by the late Howard Zinn. It's called Against War. At 10, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll hear Flashpoints, which features a recent speech given by American Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges. At